It had all gone off very well, Penrod decided, as he wandered down the terrace of the Consular Palace before he retired for the night. He came to a stately tamarind tree whose branches overshadowed half the terrace and leant against the trunk. He was smoking the Cuban cigar that Ryder Courtney had pressed upon him when they parted. Courtney had declined the invitation to attend the executions. "I don't blame him. I myself would rather have been employed elsewhere," he murmured. He felt slightly queasy as he thought about it now, and he took a long, deep draw on the cigar. At 5 o'clock that afternoon, almost the entire garrison of Khartoum had paraded on the Maidan to witness punishment. Only the minimum strength was left to man the defences of the city. Although they had not been ordered to do so, it seemed that the entire civilian populace, too, lined the perimeter of the parade, 3 and 4 deep. The 8 Krupp's guns were lined up, wheel to wheel, and aimed at maximum elevation toward the besieging dervish hordes in Omdurman. The ammunition shortage was too severe to waste even these 8 rounds. After they had completed the primary destruction, they would fly on across the river to burst among the legions of besiegers and, with luck, kill a few more of the enemy. The first to be marched out were the black marketeers and merchants of the city who had been caught red-handed with stocks of Al-Farouk's grain. Ali Muhammad Akrani was at the head of the file. When Penrod had searched his premises behind the hospital, he had found 600 sacks hidden in the slave cells under the barracoons. The prisoners were lined up close behind the guns. Gordon Pasha had sentenced them to watch the executions. In addition, all their possessions, including the contraband Dara, were confiscated. Finally, they were to be expelled from the city to take their chances on the clemency of the Mahdi and his Ansar across the river. Penrod considered their fate. "Given the same choice, I think I would have preferred the kiss of the gunner's daughter," he decided. His mind went back to that afternoon's programme of entertainment on the Maidan. When all the spectators were assembled, Penrod had given the order, and Major Al-Farouk and the 7 other condemned men were marched out from the cells of Mukran Fort. They wore full dress uniform. Each man stood to attention in front of the artillery piece to which he was allocated. The regimental sergeant-major read out the charges and sentences in a stentorian voice that carried to every one of the spectators. They craned forward to catch the words, "That they shall be shot from guns." A hum of anticipation went up from the packed ranks. This was something none of them had ever witnessed. They held up their babies and young children for a better view. They watched the sergeant-major roll up the charge sheet and hand it to the gunner, who carried it to where Gordon Pasha and Captain Ballantyne stood. The man saluted and handed the roll to the general. "Very well," Gordon returned the salute. "Carry out the sentences." The sergeant marched smartly down the rank of condemned men, halting before each in turn, and ceremoniously ripping the insignias of rank and merit from their shoulders and the breasts of their tunics. He threw the golden crowns, chevrons, and medals into the dust. When the 8 men stood in their torn clothing, forlorn and dishonoured, he gave another order. One at a time, the condemned were led to the waiting guns and spread-eagled over them. The gaping muzzles were aimed into the centre of their chests, and their arms strapped along each side of the shining black barrels. From this grotesque embrace they would receive the kiss of the gunner's daughter. Al-Farouk threw himself down in the dust of the parade ground. He howled, wept, and drummed his heels. Finally, he had to be carried to his gun by the soldiers. "Prepare to carry out the sentence," the sergeant-major bellowed. "Carry on, sergeant-major," Penrod snapped back, his face and voice expressionless. The sergeant-major drew his sword and raised the bare blade. The drummer boy at his side raised his sticks to his lips, then dropped them to the drumhead in a long roll. The sergeant-major dropped his sword blade, and the drummer stopped abruptly. There was a momentary silence, and even Penrod drew a sharp breath. The first gun bellowed. The victim disappeared for an instant in a cloud of dense grey powder smoke. Then the separate parts of his torso were spinning high in the air. There was a stunned silence after the explosion, then a spontaneous burst of cheering from the spectators, as the head fell back to earth and rolled across the sun-baked clay. The sergeant major raised his sword again. The drum rolled and was again abruptly cut short. Another thunderous discharge. This time the spectators were anticipating the result, and the wild applause was mixed with hoots of laughter. Al-Farouk was last in line, and as his turn came closer, he screamed for mercy. The crowd yelled in imitation, and Al-Farouk's bowels voided noisily. Liquid feces stained the back of his breeches. The hilarity of the watchers swelled to a bellow as the drum rolled for the eighth and last time. Al-Farouk's head leapt higher in the air than that of any man who had preceded him. Penrod examined the stub of his cigar and decided regretfully that he could not take another draw without scorching his fingers. He dropped it onto the flags of the terrace and ground it out under his heel. Although it was late, and he had already made his nightly rounds of the city's defences, he still had a pile of paperwork to complete before he could think of bed. Gordon would want all his lists and reports first thing in the morning. The little martinet made no allowances for the contingencies of the siege and the heavy load he had already placed on Penrod's shoulders. "We have to keep up to scratch, Ballantyne, and set an example." "At least he spares himself even less than he does me," Penrod thought. He straightened up from the tree, preparing to make his way up to the quarters that David Benbrook had allocated to him, when a small movement on one of the second-floor balconies caught his eye. The door to the balcony had opened, and he was able to see into the room beyond it. The interior was lit by an oil lamp that stood on a lady's dressing table, and he could just make out the upright posts and canopy of the bed. The wallpaper was patterned with red roses and sprigs of greenery. A slim, feminine figure appeared in the doorway, backlit by the lamp, which spun a golden nimbus about her head like a medieval painting of the Madonna. Even though he could not see her face, he recognised Rebecca immediately. She wore a robe of some lustrous material with a pale blue sheen, probably crepe de chine. It fitted her closely, emphasising the curve of her waist and hip, and leaving her arms bare below the elbows. She came to the front of the balcony, where the moonlight added subtle silver tones to the golden lamplight behind her. She gazed down on the garden and terrace below her, but did not see him, half concealed by the wide branches of the tamarind. She gathered her skirts and, with a graceful movement, swung her lower body up until she was sitting on the balcony wall. Her feet were bare, and her legs exposed to the knees. Her calves were shapely, her feet small and girlish. Penrod was enthralled by their elegance. Now the lamplight struck her in profile and left the other half of her face in mysterious moon shadow. She held an ivory-backed brush in one hand, and her long blonde hair was loose. She stroked the brush through it, beginning at the pale parting that ran down the centre of her scalp and ending at her waist, where the tresses danced and rippled. Her expression was serene and lovely. Penrod wanted to move close enough to study every plane and angle of her face, and perhaps even to catch a trace of her perfume. Despite the gloves, the long sleeves, and the wide-brimmed straw hat that she wore habitually during the day, the skin of Rebecca's bare arms and legs was not fashionably milky, but a light gold. Her neck was long and graceful, her head tilted at a beguiling angle. She began to hum softly. He did not recognize the tune, but it was a siren song he could not resist. He moved closer to the balcony with the caution of a hunter, waited for her to close her eyes briefly at the completion of each brushstroke before he took another small step towards her. Now he could hear the intake of her breath at the end of each bar of the tune and almost feel the warmth and texture of her lips under his own. He imagined the tremulous way in which they would part to allow him to taste the apple-sweet juices of her mouth. At last she set aside the brush, twisted her hair into a thick rope and coiled it on top of her head. She drew a long hairpin with a jewelled head from the lapel of her gown and reached up to secure her hair. As she did so, she turned her head away, and Penrod took advantage of this to step forward again. She froze like a gazelle sensing the stalk of the leopard. He stood still and held his breath. Then she turned to face him, and her eyes flew wide. She stared down at him for a moment, then swung her legs back into the balcony and sprang to her feet. Her lips framed a silent accusation. "You were spying!" Then she whirled away through the open door and closed it behind her, with just a faint click of the latch, as though she did not want anyone else to hear. As though the fact that he had been spying on her was a secret between them, Penrod's heart was drumming and his breath came faster. He regretted that he had frightened her away. He wished he had been able to watch her a little longer, as though he might have learnt some secret by studying her unsuspecting face. He left the terrace, and as he mounted the main spiral staircase to his own quarters, his predatory instinct, which for a brief interlude had been replaced by an almost reverential awe, reasserted itself. He smiled. At least we now know where to find Mademoiselle's boudoir, should the need arise, he thought.